that paradigm, the shaman therapist carefully orchestrates extra pharmacological variables, such as set and setting, in order to put the hyper-suggestible properties of these medicines to best use. This is precisely where psychedelic therapy seems to be operating, on a frontier between spirituality and science that is as provocative as it is uncomfortable. Yet the new research into psychedelics comes along at a time when mental health treatment in this country is so broken, to use the word of Tom Insel, who until 2015 was director of the National Institute of Mental Health, that the field's willingness to entertain radical new approaches is perhaps greater than it has been in a generation. The pharmacological toolbox for treating depression, which afflicts nearly a tenth of all Americans and worldwide is the leading cause of disability, has little in it today, with antidepressants losing their effectiveness and the pipeline for new psychiatric drugs drying up. Pharmaceutical companies are no longer investing in the development of so-called CNS drugs, medicines targeted at the central nervous system. The mental health system reaches only a fraction of the people suffering from mental disorders, most of whom are discouraged from seeking treatment by its cost, social stigma, or ineffectiveness. There are almost 43,000 suicides every year in America, more than the number of deaths from either breast cancer or auto accidents, yet only about half of the people who take their lives have ever received mental health treatment. Broken does not seem too harsh a characterization of such a system. Jeffrey Gus, a Manhattan psychiatrist and a co-investigator on the NYU trial, thinks the moment could be ripe for psychotherapy to entertain a completely new paradigm. Gus points out that for many years now, quote, we've had this conflict between the biologically based treatments and psychodynamic treatments. They've been fighting one another for legitimacy and resources. Is mental illness a disorder of chemistry, or is it a loss of meaning in one's life? Psychedelic therapy is the wedding of those two approaches. In recent years, quote, psychiatry has gone from being brainless to being mindless, as one psychoanalyst has put it. If psychedelic therapy proves successful, it will be because it succeeds in rejoining the brain and the mind in the practice of psychotherapy. At least, that's the promise. For the therapists working with people approaching the end of life, these questions are of more than academic interest. As I chatted with Stephen Ross and Tony Bossas in the NYU treatment room, I was struck by their excitement verging on giddiness at the results they were observing in their cancer patients after a single guided psilocybin session. At first, Ross couldn't believe what he was seeing. I thought the first 10 or 20 people were plants, that they must be faking it. They were saying things like, I understand love is the most powerful force on the planet, or I had an encounter with my cancer, this black cloud of smoke. People were journeying to early parts of their lives and coming back with a profound new sense of things, new priorities. People who had been palpably scared of death, they lost their fear. The fact that a drug given once could have such an effect for so long is an unprecedented finding. We have never had anything like that in the psychiatric field. This is when Tony Bossas first told me about his experience sitting with Patrick Metis as he journeyed to a place in his mind that somehow lifted the siege of his terror. You're in this room, Bossas recalled, but you're in the presence of something large. I remember how, after 2 hours of silence, Patrick began to cry softly and say twice, birth and death is a lot of work. It's humbling to sit there. It's the most rewarding day of your career. As a palliative care specialist, Bossas spends a lot of his time with the dying. People don't realize how few tools we have in psychiatry to address existential distress, he says. Existential distress is what psychologists call the complex of depression, anxiety, and fear common in people confronting a terminal diagnosis. Xanax isn't the answer, Bossas says. If there is an answer, Bossas believes, it is going to be more spiritual in nature than pharmacological. So how do we not explore this, he asks, if it can recalibrate how we die? It was on an April Monday in 2010 that Patrick Metis, a 53-year-old television news director being treated for a cancer of his bile ducts, read the article on the front page of the New York Times that would change his death. His diagnosis had come 3 years earlier, shortly after his wife, Lisa Callahan, noticed that the whites of his eyes had suddenly turned yellow. By 2010, the cancer had spread to Patrick's lungs, and he was buckling under the weight of an especially debilitating chemotherapy regime and the dawning realization that he might not survive. The article, headlined "Hallucinogens Have Doctors Tuning In Again," briefly mentioned research at NYU where psilocybin was being tested to relieve existential distress in cancer patients. According to Lisa, Patrick had no experience with psychedelics, but he immediately determined to call NYU and volunteer. Lisa was against the idea. "I didn't want there to be an easy way out," she told me. "I wanted him to fight." Patrick placed the call anyway, and after filling out some forms and answering a long list of questions, was accepted into the trial. He was assigned to Tony Bossas. Tony was roughly the same age as Patrick. He is also a soulful man of uncommon warmth and compassion, and the two immediately hit it off. At their first meeting, Bossas told Patrick what to expect. After 3 or 4 preparatory sessions of talking therapy, Patrick would be scheduled for 2 dosings, one of them an active placebo, in this case a high dose of niacin, which produces a tingling sensation, and the other a capsule containing 25 milligrams of psilocybin. Both sessions would take place in the treatment room where I met Bossas and Ross. During each session, which would last the better part of a day, Patrick would lie on the couch wearing eye shades and listening through headphones to a playlist of carefully curated music, Brian Eno, Philip Glass, Pat Metheny, and Ravi Shankar, as well as some classical and New Age compositions. 2 sitters, one of them male, Bossas, and the other female, Crystalia Calianci, would be in attendance for the duration, saying very little, but available to help should he run into any trouble. In preparation, the two shared with Patrick the set of flight instructions written by the Hopkins researcher, Bill Richards. Bossas suggested that Patrick use the phrase, "trust and let go," as a kind of mantra for his journey. "Go wherever it takes you," he advised. "Climb staircases, open doors, explore paths, fly over landscapes." But the most important advice for the journey, he offered, is always to move toward rather than try to flee anything truly threatening or monstrous you encounter. Look it straight in the eyes. Dig in your heels and ask, "What are you doing in my mind?" or "What can I learn from you?" The idea of giving a psychedelic drug to the dying was first broached not by a therapist or scientist, but by Aldous Huxley in a letter to Humphrey Osmond proposing a research project involving, quote, "the administration of LSD to terminal cancer cases," in the hope that it would make dying a more spiritual, less strictly physiological process. Huxley himself had his wife Laura give him an injection of LSD when he was on his own deathbed on November 22, 1963. By then, Huxley's idea had been tested on a number of cancer patients in North America. In 1965, Sidney Cohen wrote an essay for Harper's, "LSD and the Anguish of Dying," exploring the potential of psychedelics to, quote, "alter the experience of dying." He described treatment with LSD as therapy by self-transcendence. The premise behind the approach was that our fear of death is a function of our egos, which burden us with a sense of separateness that can become unbearable as we approach death. "We are born into an egoless world," Cohen wrote, "but we live and die imprisoned within ourselves." The idea was to use psychedelics to escape the prison of self. Quote, "We wanted to provide a brief, lucid interval of complete egolessness to demonstrate that personal intactness was not absolutely necessary and that perhaps there was something out there, something greater than our individual selves that might survive our demise." Cohen quoted a patient, a woman dying of ovarian cancer, describing the shift in her perspective following an LSD session. "My extinction is not of great consequence at this moment, not even for me. It's just another turn in the swing of existence and non-existence. I feel it has little to do with the church or talk of death. I suppose that I'm detached, that's it, away from myself and my pain and my decaying. I could die nicely now, if it should be so. I do not invite it, nor do I put it off. In 1972, Stanislav Grof and Bill Richards, who were working together at Spring Grove, wrote that LSD gave patients an experience, quote, of cosmic unity, such that death, instead of being seen as the absolute end of everything and a step into nothingness, they wrote, appears suddenly as a transition into another type of existence. The idea of possible continuity of consciousness beyond physical death becomes much more plausible than the opposite. Volunteers in the NYU psilocybin trial are required to write an account of their journey soon after its completion, and Patrick Metis, who worked in journalism, took the assignment seriously. His wife Lisa said that after his Friday session, Patrick labored all weekend to make sense of the experience and write it down. Lisa agreed to share his account with me and also gave Patrick's therapist, Tony Bassas, permission to show me the notes he took during the session, as well as his notes from several follow-up psychotherapy sessions. Lisa, who at the time worked as a marketing executive for a cookware company, had an important meeting on that January morning in 2011, so Patrick came by himself to the treatment room in the NYU Dental School on 1st Avenue and 24th Street, taking the subway from their apartment in Brooklyn. The treatment room was in the dental college because, at the time, both Bellevue and NYU's Cancer Center wanted to keep their distance from a trial involving psychedelics. Tony Bassas and Cristalia Calianzi, his guides, greeted him, reviewed the day's plans, and then at 9 a.m. presented Patrick with a chalice containing the pill. Whether it contained psilocybin or the placebo, none of them would know for at least 30 minutes. Patrick was asked to state his intention, which he said was to learn to cope better with the anxiety and depression he felt about his cancer, and to work on what he called his regret in life. He placed a few photographs around the room of himself and Lisa on their wedding day and of their dog, Arlo. At 9:30, Patrick lay down on the couch, put on the headphones and eye shades, and fell quiet. In his account, Patrick likened the start of the journey to the launch of a space shuttle, a physically violent and rather clunky liftoff, he wrote, which eventually gave way to the blissful serenity of weightlessness. Many of the volunteers I interviewed reported initial episodes of intense fear and anxiety before giving themselves up to the experience, as the guides encouraged them to do. This is where the flight instructions come in. Their promise is that if you surrender to whatever happens, trust, let go and be open, or relax and float downstream, whatever at first might seem terrifying will soon morph into something else, and likely something pleasant, even blissful. Early in his journey, Patrick encountered his brother's wife, who died of cancer more than 20 years earlier at 43. Ruth acted as my tour guide, he wrote, and didn't seem surprised to see me. She wore her translucent body so I would know her. This period of my journey seemed to be about the feminine. Michelle Obama made an appearance. The considerable feminine energy all around me made clear the idea that a mother, any mother, regardless of her shortcomings, could never not love her offspring. This was very powerful. I knew I was crying. It was here that I felt as if I was coming out of the womb, being birthed again. My rebirth was smooth, comforting. Outwardly, however, what was happening to Patrick appeared to be anything but smooth. He was crying, Bassas noted, and breathing heavily. This is when he first said, "Birth and death is a lot of work," and seemed to be convulsing. Then Patrick reached out and clutched Calianzi's hand while pulling up his knees and pushing, as if he were delivering a baby. From Bassas's notes. 11:15. Oh, God. 11:25. It's really so simple. 11:47. Who knew a man could give birth? And then, I gave birth. To what? I don't know. 12:10. It's just too amazing. Patrick is alternately laughing and crying at this point. Oh, God, it all makes sense now. So simple and beautiful. Now Patrick asked to take a break. It was getting too intense, he wrote. He removed the headphones and eye shades. I sat up and spoke with Tony and Crystalia. I mentioned that everyone deserved to have this experience, that if everyone did, no one could ever do harm to another again. Wars would be impossible to wage. The room and everything in it was beautiful. Tony and Crystalia, sitting on their pillows, were radiant. They helped him to the bathroom. Even the germs, if there were any present, were beautiful, as was everything in our world and universe. Afterward, he voiced some reluctance to, quote, go back in. The work was considerable, but I loved the sense of adventure. Eventually, he put his eye shades and headphones on and lay back down. From here on, he wrote, love was the only consideration. It was and is the only purpose. Love seemed to emanate from a single point of light, and it vibrated. I could feel my physical body trying to vibrate in unity with the cosmos, and frustratingly, I felt like a guy who couldn't dance, but the universe accepted it. The sheer joy, the bliss, the nirvana was indescribable. And in fact, there are no words to accurately capture my experience, my state, this place. I know I've had no earthly pleasure that's ever come close to this feeling. No sensation, no image of beauty, nothing during my time on earth has felt as pure and joyful and glorious as the height of this journey. Aloud, he said, never had an orgasm of the soul before. The music loomed large in the experience. I was learning a song, and the song was simple. It was one note, C. It was the vibration of the universe, a collection of everything that ever existed, all together equaling God. Patrick then described an epiphany having to do with simplicity. He was thinking about politics and food, music and architecture, and his field, television news, which he realized was, like so much else, overproduced. We put too many notes in a song, too many ingredients in our recipes, too many flourishes in the clothes we wear, the houses we live in. It all seemed so pointless when really all we needed to do was focus on the love. Just then he saw Derek Jeter, then the Yankee shortstop, making yet another balletic turn to first base. I was convinced in that moment I had figured it all out. It was right there in front of me, love. The only thing that mattered. This was now to be my life's cause. Then he said something that Bossis jotted down at 12:15. Okay, I get it. You can all punch out now. Our work is done. But it wasn't done. Not yet. Now I took a tour of my lungs. I remember breathing deeply to help facilitate the seeing. Bossis noted that at 2:30, Patrick had said, I went into my lungs and saw two spots. They were no big deal. I was being told, without words, not to worry about the cancer. It's minor in the scheme of things, simply an imperfection of your humanity, and that the more important matter, the real work to be done, is before you. Again, love. Now Patrick experienced what he called a brief death. I approached what appeared to be a very sharp, pointed piece of stainless steel. It had a razor blade quality to it. I continued up to the apex of this shiny metal object, and as I arrived, I had a choice, to look or not look, over the edge and into the infinite abyss, the vastness of the universe, the eye of everything and of nothing. I was hesitant, but not frightened. I wanted to go all in, but felt that if I did, I would possibly leave my body permanently, death from this life. But it was not a difficult decision. I knew there was much more for me here. Telling his guides about his choice, Patrick explained that he, quote, was not ready to jump off and leave Lisa. Then, rather suddenly, around 3 p.m., it was over. The transition from a state where I had no sense of time or space to the relative dullness of now happened quickly. I had a headache. When Lisa arrived to take him home, Patrick looked like he had run a race, she recalled. The color in his face was not good. He looked tired and sweaty, but he was on fire. He was lit up with all the things he wanted to tell me and all the things he couldn't. He told her he had touched the face of God. Every psychedelic journey is different, yet a few common themes seem to recur in the journeys of those struggling with cancer. Many of the cancer patients I interviewed described an experience of either giving birth or being reborn, though none quite as intense as Patrick's. Many also described an encounter with their cancer or their fear of it that had the effect of shrinking its power over them. I mentioned earlier the experience of Dinah Baser, a petite and mild New Yorker in her 60s, a figure skating instructor who was diagnosed with ovarian cancer in 2010. When we met in the NYU treatment room, Dinah, who has auburn curls and wore large hoop earrings, told me that even after a successful course of chemotherapy, she was paralyzed by the fear of a recurrence and said she wasted her days waiting for the other shoe to drop. She too worked with Tony Bossas, and in the difficult first moments of her session, imagined herself trapped in the hold of a ship, rocking back and forth, consumed by fear. I stuck my hand out from under the blanket and said, "I'm so scared." Tony took my hand and told me to just go with it. His hand became my anchor. I saw my fear, almost as in a dream. My fear was located under my rib cage on the left side. It was not my tumor, but it was this black thing in my body, and it made me immensely angry. I was enraged by my fear. I screamed, "Get the fuck out! I won't be eaten alive!" And you know what? It was gone. It went away. I drove it away with my anger. Dinah reports that years later, it hasn't returned. "The cancer is something completely out of my control," she says, "but the fear," I realized, "is not." Dinah's epiphany gave way to feelings of overwhelming love as her thoughts turned from her fear to her children. She told me she was and remains a solid atheist, and yet the phrase that I used, which I hate to use, but it's the only way to describe it, is that I felt bathed in God's love. Paradox is a hallmark of the mystical experience, and the contradiction between the divine love Dinah felt and not having a shred of belief didn't seem to faze her. When I pointed this out, she shrugged and then smiled. What other way is there to express it? Not surprisingly, visions of death loom large in the journeys taken by the cancer patients I interviewed at NYU and Hopkins. A breast cancer survivor in her 60s, who asked to remain anonymous, described zipping merrily through space as if in a video game until she arrived smack at the wall of a crematorium and realized with a fright, "I've died, and now I'm going to be cremated. But I didn't have the experience of burning. How could I? I was dead. The next thing I know, I'm below ground in this gorgeous forest, deep woods, loamy and brown. There are roots all around me, and I'm seeing the trees growing, and I'm part of them. I had died, but I was there in the ground with all these roots, and it didn't feel sad or happy, just natural, contented, peaceful. I wasn't gone. I was part of the earth." Several cancer patients described edging up to the precipice of death and looking over to the other side before drawing back. Tammy Burgess, diagnosed with ovarian cancer at 55, found herself peering across the great plane of consciousness. "It was very serene and beautiful," she said. "I felt alone, but I could reach out and touch anyone I'd ever known. When my time came, that's where my life would go once it left me, and that was okay." The uncanny authority of the psychedelic experience might help explain why so many cancer patients in the trials reported that their fear of death had lifted or at least abated. They had stared directly at death and come to know something about it in a kind of dress rehearsal. "A high-dose psychedelic experience is death practice," says Catherine McLean, the former Hopkins psychologist. "You're losing everything you know to be real, letting go of your ego and your body, and that process can feel like dying. And yet the experience brings the comforting news that there is something on the other side of that death, whether it is the great plane of consciousness or one's ashes underground being taken up by the roots of trees, and some abiding disembodied intelligence to somehow know it. Now I am aware that there is a whole other reality," one NYU volunteer told a researcher a few months after her journey. "Compared to other people, it is like I know another language." At a follow-up session with Tony Bossas a few weeks after his journey, Patrick Metis, whom his wife Lisa describes as an earthy, connected person, a doer, discussed the idea of an afterlife. Bossas' notes indicate that Patrick interpreted his journey as pretty clearly a window on a kind of afterlife, something beyond this physical body. He spoke of the plane of existence of love as infinite. In subsequent sessions, Patrick talked about his body and cancer as a type of illusion. It also became clear that, psychologically at least, Patrick was doing remarkably well in the aftermath of his session. He was meditating regularly, felt he had become better able to live in the present, and, quote, described loving his wife even more. In a session in March, 2 months out from his journey, Bossis noted that Patrick, though slowly dying of cancer, feels the happiest in his life. Bossis quotes him, "I am the luckiest man on earth." How much should the authenticity of these experiences concern us? Most of the therapists involved in the research take a scrupulously pragmatic view of the question. They're fixed on relieving their patients' suffering and exhibit scant interest in metaphysical theories or questions of truth. "That's above my pay grade," Tony Bossis said with a shrug when I asked him whether he thought the experience of cosmic consciousness described by his patients were fictive or real. Asked the same question, Bill Richards cited William James, who suggested we judge the mystical experience not by its veracity, which is unknowable, but by its fruits. Does it turn someone's life in a positive direction? Many researchers acknowledge that a strong placebo effect may be at work when a drug as suggestible as psilocybin is administered by medical professionals with legal and institutional sanction. Under such conditions, the expectations of the therapist are much more likely to be fulfilled by the patient, and bad trips are much less likely to occur. Here we bump into one of the richer paradoxes of the psilocybin trials. While it succeeds in no small part because it has the sanction and authority of science, its effectiveness seems to depend on a mystical experience that leaves people convinced there is more to this world than science can explain. Science is being used to validate an experience that would appear to undermine the scientific perspective in what might be called white coat shamanism. Are questions of truth important if the therapy helps people who are suffering? I had difficulty finding anyone involved in the research who was troubled by such questions. David Nichols, the retired Purdue University chemist and pharmacologist who founded the Hefter Research Institute in 1993 to support psychedelic research, including the trials at Hopkins, for which he synthesized the psilocybin, puts the pragmatic case most baldly. In a 2014 interview with Science Magazine, he said, "If it gives them peace, if it helps people to die peacefully with their friends and their family at their side, I don't care if it's real or an illusion." For his part, Roland Griffiths acknowledges that, quote, "authenticity is a scientific question not yet answered. All we have to go by is the phenomenology. That is, what people tell us about their internal experiences. That's when he began querying me about my own spiritual development, which I confessed was still fairly rudimentary. I told him my worldview had always been staunchly materialist. Okay, then, but what about the miracle that we are conscious, he said. Just think about that for a second, that we are aware and that we are aware that we are aware. How unlikely is that? How can we be certain, he was suggesting, that our experience of consciousness is authentic? The answer is we can't. It is beyond the reach of our science, and yet who doubts its reality? In fact, the evidence for the existence of consciousness is much like the evidence for the reality of the mystical experience. We believe it exists not because science can independently verify it, but because a great many people have been convinced of its reality. Here, too, all we have to go on is the phenomenology. Griffiths was suggesting that, insofar as I was on board for one miracle well beyond the reach of materialist science, the marvel of consciousness, as Vladimir Nabokov once called it, that sudden window swinging open on a sunlit landscape amidst the night of non-being, maybe I needed to keep a more open mind to the possibility of others. In December 2016, a front-page story in the New York Times reported on the dramatic results of the Johns Hopkins and NYU psilocybin cancer studies, which were published together in a special issue of the Journal of Psychopharmacology, along with nearly a dozen commentaries from prominent voices in the mental health establishment, including two past presidents of the American Psychiatric Association, hailing the findings. In both the NYU and the Hopkins trials, some 80% of cancer patients showed clinically significant reductions in standard measures of anxiety and depression, an effect that endured for at least 6 months after their psilocybin session. In both trials, the intensity of the mystical experience volunteers reported closely correlated with the degree to which their symptoms subsided. Few, if any, psychiatric interventions of any kind have demonstrated such dramatic and sustained results. The statistical effect size of these results, at or above 1.0 for most of the outcome measures used in both trials, is remarkable for a psychiatric treatment. As a comparison, when the SSRI antidepressants had their first clinical trials, the effect size was only 0.3, which was good enough for them to be approved. The trials were small, 80 subjects in all, and will have to be repeated on a larger scale before the government will consider rescheduling psilocybin and approving the treatment. But the results were encouraging enough to win the attention and cautious support of the mental health community, which has called for more research. Dozens of medical schools have asked to participate in future trials, and funders have stepped forward to underwrite those trials. After decades in the shadows, psychedelic therapy is suddenly respectable again, or nearly so. New York University, which proudly promoted the results of a trial it had once only tolerated somewhat grudgingly, invited Stephen Ross to move his treatment room from the dental college into the main hospital. Even the NYU Cancer Center, which had initially been reluctant to refer patients to the psilocybin trial, asked Ross to set up a treatment room on its premises for an upcoming trial. The papers offered little in the way of a theory to explain the effects of psilocybin, except to point out that the patients with the best outcomes were the ones who had the most complete mystical experience. But exactly why should that experience translate into relief from anxiety and depression? Is it the intimation of some kind of immortality that accounts for the effect? This seems too simple and fails to account for the variety of experiences people had, many of which did not dwell on an afterlife. And some of the ones that did conceived of what happens after death in naturalistic terms, as when the anonymous volunteer imagined herself as part of the earth, molecules of matter being taken up by the roots of trees. This really happens. Of course, the mystical experience consists of several components, most of which don't require a supernatural explanation. The dissolution of the sense of self, for example, can be understood in either psychological or neurobiological terms, as possibly the disintegration of the default mode network, and may explain many of the benefits people experience during their journeys without resort to a spiritual conception of oneness. Likewise, the sense of sacredness that classically accompanies the mystical experience can be understood in more secular terms as simply a heightened sense of meaning or purpose. It's still early days in our understanding of consciousness, and no single one of our vocabularies for approaching the subject, the biological, the psychological, the philosophical, or the spiritual, has yet earned the right to claim it has the final word. It may be that by layering these different perspectives one upon the other, we can gain the richest picture of what might be going on. In a follow-up study to the NYU trial, Patient Experiences of Psilocybin-Assisted Psychotherapy, published in the Journal of Humanistic Psychology in 2017, Alexander Belser, a member of the NYU team, interviewed volunteers to better understand the psychological mechanisms underlying the transformations they had experienced. I read the study as a subtle attempt to move beyond the mystical experience paradigm to a more humanistic one, and at the same time to underscore the importance of the psychotherapist in the psychedelic experience. Note the use of the term psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy in the title. Neither of the papers in psychopharmacology mentions psychotherapy in its title, only the drug. A few key themes emerged. All of the patients interviewed described powerful feelings of connection to loved ones, relational embeddedness is the term the authors used, and more generally, a shift, quote, from feelings of separateness to interconnectedness. In most cases, this shift was accompanied by a repertoire of powerful emotions, including, quote, exalted feelings of joy, bliss, and love. Difficult passages during the journey were typically followed by positive feelings of surrender and acceptance, even of their cancers, as people's fears fell away. Jeffrey Guss, a co-author on the paper and a psychiatrist, interprets what happens during the session in terms of the psilocybin's egolytic effects, the drug's ability to either silence or at least muffle the voice of the ego. In his view, which is informed by his psychoanalytic training, the ego is a mental construct that performs certain functions on behalf of the self. Chief among these are maintaining the boundary between the conscious and the unconscious realms of the mind, and the boundary between self and other, or subject and object. It is only when these boundaries fade or disappear, as they seem to do under the influence of psychedelics, that we can, quote, let go of rigid patterns of thought, allowing us to perceive new meanings with less fear. The whole question of meaning is central to the approach of the NYU therapists, and is perhaps especially helpful in understanding the experience of the cancer patients on psilocybin. For many of these patients, a diagnosis of terminal cancer constitutes, among other things, a crisis of meaning. Why me? Why have I been singled out for this fate? Is there any sense to life in the universe? Under the weight of this existential crisis, one's horizon shrinks, one's emotional repertoire contracts, and one's focus narrows as the mind turns in on itself, shutting out the world. Loops of rumination and worry come to occupy more of one's mental time and space, reinforcing habits of thought it becomes ever more difficult to escape. Existential distress at the end of life bears many of the hallmarks of a hyperactive default network, including obsessive self-reflection and an inability to jump the deepening grooves of negative thinking. The ego, faced with the prospect of its own extinction, turns inward and becomes hypervigilant, withdrawing its investment in the world and other people. The cancer patients I interviewed spoke of feeling closed off from loved ones, from the world, and from the full range of emotions. They felt, as one put it, existentially alone. By temporarily disabling the ego, psilocybin seems to open a new field of psychological possibility, symbolized by the death and rebirth reported by many of the patients I interviewed. At first, the falling away of the self feels threatening, but if one can let go and surrender, powerful and usually positive emotions flow in, along with formerly inaccessible memories and sense impressions and meanings. No longer defended by the ego, the gate between self and other, Huxley's reducing valve, is thrown wide open. And what comes through that opening for many people in a great flood is love. Love for specific individuals, yes, but also, as Patrick Metis came to feel, to know, love for everyone and everything. Love is the meaning and purpose of life, the key to the universe, and the ultimate truth. So it may be that the loss of self leads to a gain in meaning. Can this be explained biologically? Probably not yet, but recent neuroscience offers a few intriguing clues. Recall that the Imperial College team found that when the default mode network disintegrates, taking with it the sense of self, the brain's overall connectivity increases, allowing brain regions that don't ordinarily communicate to form new lines of connection. Is it possible that some of these new connections in the brain manifest in the mind as new meanings or perspectives, the connecting of formerly far-flung dots? It may also be that psychedelics can directly imbue otherwise irrelevant sensory information with meaning. A recent paper in Current Biology described an experiment in which pieces of music that held no personal relevance for volunteers were played for them while on LSD. Under the influence of the psychedelic, however, volunteers attributed marked and lasting personal meaning to the same songs. These medicines may help us to construct meaning, if not discover it. No doubt the suggestibility of the mind on psychedelics and the guiding presence of psychotherapists also play a role in attributing meaning to the experience. In preparing volunteers for their journeys, Jeffrey Guss speaks explicitly about the acquisition of meaning, telling his patients, quote, that the medicine will show you hidden or unknown shadow parts of yourself, that you will gain insight into yourself and come to learn about the meaning of life and existence. He also tells them they may have a mystical or transcendent experience, but carefully refrains from defining it. As a result of this molecule being in your body, he tells them, you'll understand more about yourself and life and the universe. And more often than not, this happens. Replace the sciencey word molecule with sacred mushroom or plant teacher, and you have the incantations of a shaman at the start of a ceremonial healing. But however it works, and whatever vocabulary we use to explain it, this seems to me the great gift of the psychedelic journey, especially to the dying. Its power to imbue everything in our field of experience with a heightened sense of purpose and consequence. Depending on one's orientation, this can be understood either in humanistic or in spiritual terms, for what is the sacred but a capitalized version of significance? Even for atheists like Dinah Baser, like me, psychedelics can charge a world from which the gods long ago departed with the pulse of meaning, the imminence with which they once infused it. The sense of a cold and arbitrary universe governed purely by chance is banished. Especially in the absence of faith, these medicines in the right hands may offer powerful antidotes for the existential terrors that afflict not only the dying. To believe that life has any meaning at all is, of course, a large presumption, requiring in some a leap of faith, but surely it is a helpful one, and never more so than at the approach of death. To situate the self in a larger context of meaning, whatever it is, a sense of oneness with nature or universal love, can make extinction of the self somewhat easier to contemplate. Religion has always understood this wager, but why should religion enjoy a monopoly? Bertrand Russell wrote that the best way to overcome one's fear of death, quote, is to make your interests gradually wider and more impersonal until bit by bit the walls of the ego recede and your life becomes increasingly merged in the universal life. He goes on, an individual human existence should be like a river, small at first, narrowly contained within its banks and rushing passionately past rocks and over waterfalls. Gradually the river grows wider, the banks recede, the waters flow more quietly, and in the end, without any visible break, they become merged in the sea and painlessly lose their individual being. Patrick Metis lived 17 months after his psilocybin session, and according to Lisa, those months were filled with a great many unexpected satisfactions, alongside Patrick's dawning acceptance that he was going to die. Lisa had initially been wary of the NYU trial, interpreting Patrick's desire to participate as a sign he'd given up the fight. In the event, he came away convinced he still had much to do in this life, much love to give and receive, and wasn't yet ready to leave it, and especially his wife. Patrick's psychedelic journey had shifted his perspective from a narrow lens trained on the prospect of dying to a renewed focus on how best to live the time left to him. He had a new resolve, Lisa recalls, that there was a point to his life, that he got it and was moving with it. We still had our arguments, Lisa says, and we had a very trying summer as they endured a calamitous apartment renovation in Brooklyn. That was hell on earth, Lisa recalled, but Patrick had changed. He had a sense of patience he had never had before, and with me, he had real joy about things. It was as if he had been relieved of the duty of caring about the details of life, and he could let all that go. Now it was about being with people, enjoying his sandwich and the walk on the promenade. It was as if we lived a lifetime in a year. After the psilocybin session, Lisa somehow convinced herself that Patrick was not going to die after all. He continued with his chemo and his spirits improved, but she now thinks all this time he knew very well he wasn't going to make it. Lisa continued to work, and Patrick spent his good days walking the city. He would walk everywhere, try every restaurant for lunch, and tell me about all the great places he discovered. But his good days got fewer and fewer. Then, in March 2012, he told her he wanted to stop chemo. He didn't want to die, Lisa says, but I think he just decided this is not how he wanted to live. That fall, his lungs began to fail, and Patrick wound up in the hospital. Says Lisa, he gathered everyone together and said goodbye and explained that this is how he wanted to die. He had a very conscious death. Patrick's seeming equanimity in the face of death exerted a powerful influence on everyone around him, Lisa said, and his room in the palliative care unit at Mount Sinai became a center of gravity in the hospital. Everyone, the nurses and the doctors, wanted to hang out in our room. They just didn't want to leave. Patrick would talk and talk. It was like he was a yogi. He put out so much love. When Tony Bossas visited Patrick a week before he died, he was struck by the mood in the room and by Patrick's serenity. "He was consoling me," Bossas recalls. "He said his biggest sadness was leaving his wife, but he was not afraid." Lisa emailed me a photograph of Patrick she had taken a few days before he died, and when the image popped open on my screen, it momentarily took my breath away. Here was an emaciated man in a hospital gown, an oxygen clip in his nose, but with bright, shining blue eyes and a broad smile. On the eve of death, the man was beaming. Lisa stayed with Patrick in the hospital room night after night, the two of them often talking into the wee hours. "I feel like I have one foot in this world and one in the next," he told her at one point. One of the last nights we were together, he said, "Honey, don't push me. I'm finding my way." At the same time, he sought to comfort her. "This is simply the wheel of life," she recalls him saying. "You feel like you're being ground down by it now, but the wheel is going to turn, and you'll be on top again." Lisa hadn't had a shower in days, and her brother finally persuaded her to go home for a few hours. Minutes before she returned to his bedside, Patrick slipped away. "I went home to shower," she says, "and he died. We were speaking on the phone, and I could hear her crying softly. He wasn't going to die as long as I was there. My brother had told me, 'You need to let him go.'" Patrick was gone by the time she got back to the hospital. He had died seconds before. It was like something had evaporated from him. "I sat with him for 3 hours. It's a long time before the soul is out of the room." "It was a good death," Lisa told me, a fact she credits to the people at NYU and to Patrick's psilocybin journey. "I feel indebted to them for what they allowed him to experience, the deep resources they allowed him to tap into. These were his own deep resources. That, I think, is what these mind-altering drugs do." "Patrick was far more spiritual than I was to begin with," Lisa told me the last time we spoke. "It was clear his journey had changed her, too. It was an affirmation of a world I knew nothing about, but there are more dimensions to this world than I ever knew existed." Part 2. Addiction. The dozen or so Apollo astronauts who have escaped Earth's orbit and traveled to the moon had the privilege of seeing the planet from a perspective never before available to our species, and several of them reported that the experience changed them in profound and enduring ways. The sight of that pale blue dot hanging in the infinite black void of space erased the national borders on our maps and rendered Earth small, vulnerable, exceptional, and precious. Edgar Mitchell, returning from the moon on Apollo 14, had what he described as a mystical experience, specifically a Savikalpa Samadhi, in which the ego vanishes when confronted with the immensity of the universe during the course of a meditation on an object, in this case, planet Earth. "The biggest joy was on the way home," he recalled. "In my cockpit window, every 2 minutes, the Earth, the moon, the sun, and the whole panorama of the heavens. That was a powerful, overwhelming experience. And suddenly I realized that the molecules of my body and the molecules of my spacecraft, the molecules in the body of my partners, were prototyped, manufactured in some ancient generation of stars. I felt an overwhelming sense of oneness, of connectedness. It wasn't them and us. It was, that's me. That's all of it. It's one thing." And it was accompanied by an ecstasy, a sense of, oh my God, wow, yes, an insight, an epiphany. The experience would shape his post-NASA work. The former engineer established the Institute of Noetic Sciences to study consciousness and paranormal phenomena. It was the power of this novel perspective, the same perspective that Stuart Brand, after his 1966 LSD trip on a North Beach rooftop, worked so hard to disseminate to the culture, that helped to inspire the modern environmental movement, as well as the Gaia hypothesis, the idea that Earth and its atmosphere together constitute a single living organism. I thought about this so-called overview effect during my conversations with volunteers in the psilocybin trials, and especially with those who had overcome their addictions after a psychedelic journey, to inner space, if you will. Several volunteers described achieving a new distance on their own lives, a vantage from which matters that had once seemed daunting now seemed smaller and more manageable, including their addictions. It sounded as though the psychedelic experience had given many of them an overview effect on the scenes of their own lives, making possible a shift in worldview and priorities that allowed them to let go of old habits, sometimes with remarkable ease. As one lifetime smoker put it to me in terms so simple I found it hard to believe, "Smoking became irrelevant, so I stopped." The smoking cessation pilot study in which this man took part, his name is Charles Besant, and he has been abstinent now for 6 years, was directed by Matthew Johnson, a protege of Roland Griffiths at Johns Hopkins, where the study took place. Johnson is a psychologist in his early 40s who, like Griffiths, trained as a behaviorist, studying things like operant conditioning in rats. Tall, slender, and angular, Johnson wears a scrupulously trimmed black beard and oversized retro-nerd black glasses that make him look a little like Ira Glass. His interest in psychedelics goes back to his college days when he read Ram Dass and learned about the Harvard Psilocybin Project, but never did he dare to imagine he would someday have a job working with them in a laboratory. "I had it in the back of my mind that someday I wanted to do research with the psychedelic compounds," he told me when we first met in his Hopkins office, "but I figured that was a long way off in the future." Yet soon after Johnson arrived at Johns Hopkins to do a pharmacology postdoc in 2004, I found out that Roland had this super hush-hush project with psilocybin. Everything lined up perfectly. Johnson worked on the lab's early psilocybin studies, serving as a guide for several dozen sessions and helping to crunch the data before launching a study of his own in 2009. The smoking study gave 15 volunteer smokers who were trying to quit several sessions of cognitive behavioral therapy, followed by two or three doses of psilocybin. A so-called open-label study, there was no placebo, so they all knew they were getting the drug. Volunteers had to stop smoking before their psilocybin session. They had their carbon monoxide levels measured at several intervals to ensure compliance and confirm they remained abstinent. The study was tiny and not randomized, but the results were nevertheless striking, especially when you consider that smoking is one of the most difficult addictions to break, harder, some say, than heroin. 6 months after their psychedelic sessions, 80% of the volunteers were confirmed as abstinent. At the one-year mark, that figure had fallen to 67%, which is still a better rate of success than the best treatment now available. A much larger randomized study comparing the effectiveness of psilocybin therapy with the nicotine patch is currently underway. As in the cancer anxiety studies, the volunteers who had the most complete mystical experience had the best outcomes. They were, like Charles Besant, able to quit smoking. After interviewing cancer patients confronted with the prospect of death, people who had had epic journeys in which they confronted their cancers and traveled to the underworld, I wondered how the experience would compare when the stakes were lower. What kinds of journeys would ordinary people simply hoping to break a bad habit have, and what kinds of insights would they return with? Surprisingly banal, it turns out. Not that their journeys were banal. Psilocybin transported them all over the world and through history and to outer space, but the insights they brought back with them were mundane in the extreme. Alice O'Donnell, a 60-ish book editor born in Ireland, reveled in the freedom to go everywhere in the course of her journey. She grew feathers that allowed her to travel back in time to various scenes of European history, died three times, watched her soul move from her body to a funeral pyre floating on the Ganges, and found herself standing on the edge of the universe, witnessing the dawn of creation. She had the humbling realization that everything in the universe is of equal importance, including yourself. Instead of being so narrowly focused, moving through this little tunnel of adult life, she found that the journey returned me to the child's wider sense of wonder, to the world of Wordsworth. A part of my brain that had gone to sleep was awakened. The universe was so great, and there were so many things you could do and see in it, that killing yourself seemed like a dumb idea. It put smoking in a whole new context. Smoking seemed very unimportant. It seemed kind of stupid, to be honest. Alice imagined herself throwing out lots of junk from her house, emptying the attic and the basement. I had an image of tossing everything over the ledge, all the stuff I didn't need anymore. It's amazing how you can whittle things down to the few really important things that are necessary for survival. And the most important thing of all is the breath. When that stops, you're dead. She emerged from her journey with the conviction that you should cherish your breath. She has not had a cigarette since her psilocybin journey. Whenever she feels a craving, she goes back in memory to her session and thinks of all the wonderful things I experienced and how it felt to be on that much higher plane. Charles Besant had his epiphany while on a similarly higher plane. Besant, a museum exhibit designer in his 60s, found himself standing on a mountaintop in the Alps, the German states stretching out before me, all the way to the Baltic. Wagner was playing in his headphones. My ego had dissolved, yet I'm telling you this. It was terrifying. He sounded like a 19th-century romantic describing an encounter with the sublime, at once terrible and awe-inspiring. People use words like oneness, connectivity, unity. I get it. I was part of something so much larger than anything I had ever imagined. We were speaking by phone on a Saturday morning, and at one point Besant paused in his account to describe the scene before him. Right now, I'm standing here in my garden, and the light is coming through the canopy of leaves. For me to be able to stand here in the beauty of this light, talking to you, it's only because my eyes are open to see it. If you don't stop to look, you'll never see it. It's the statement of an obvious thing, I know, but to feel it, to look and be amazed by this light, is a gift he attributes to his session, which gave him, quote, a feeling of connectedness to everything. Besant followed up on our conversation by email with a series of clarifications and elaborations, striving to find the words equal to the immensity of the experience. It was in the face of this immensity that smoking suddenly seemed pitifully small. Why quit smoking? Because I found it irrelevant, because other things had become so much more important. Some volunteers marveled themselves at the simultaneous power and banality of their insights. Savannah Miller is a single mom in her 30s who works as a bookkeeper for her father's company in Maryland. Possibly because she spent her 20s tangled in an abusive relationship with a man she describes as a psychopath, her trip was painful, but ultimately cathartic. She remembers crying uncontrollably and producing tremendous amounts of snot, something her guides confirmed really happened. Savannah gave little thought to her habit during the journey, except toward the end, when she pictured herself as a smoking gargoyle. You know how gargoyles look, crouched down with their shoulders hunched? That's how I felt and saw myself, a little golem creature smoking, pulling in the smoke and not letting it out until my chest hurts and I'm choking. It was powerful and disgusting. I can still see it now, that hideous coughing gargoyle, whenever I picture myself as a smoker. Months later, she says the image is still helpful when the inevitable cravings arise. In the middle of her session, Savannah suddenly sat up and announced she had discovered something important, an epiphany that her guides needed to write down so it wouldn't be lost to posterity. Eat right, exercise, stretch. Matt Johnson refers to these realizations as duh moments and says that they are common among his volunteers and not at all insignificant. Smokers know perfectly well that their habit is unhealthy, disgusting, expensive, and unnecessary, but under the influence of psilocybin, that knowing acquires a new weight, becomes something they feel in the gut and the heart, he says. Insights like this become more compelling, stickier, and harder to avoid thinking about. These sessions deprive people of the luxury of mindlessness, our default state, and one in which addictions like smoking can flourish. Johnson believes the value of psilocybin for the addict is in the new perspective, at once obvious and profound, that it opens onto one's life and its habits. Addiction is a story we get stuck in, he says, a story that gets reinforced every time we try and fail to quit. I'm a smoker and I'm powerless to stop. The journey allows them to get some distance and see the bigger picture and to see the short-term pleasures of smoking in the larger, longer-term context of their lives. Of course, this recontextualization of an old habit doesn't just happen. Countless people have taken psilocybin and continued to smoke. If it does happen, it's because breaking the habit is the avowed intention of the session, strongly reinforced by the therapist in the preparation.